Welcome to the New Monastics Podcast, where we'll be discussing all aspects of the contemplative life and interspirituality in the context of modernity. On each episode, we will choose a topic to explore with one of today's leading teachers or thinkers. The New Monastics Podcast is a project of Charis Foundation for New Monasticism and Interspirituality, which is dedicated to the emergence of a newly conceived contemplative life of embodied spirituality and sacred activism.
Welcome, everyone, to the New Monastics Podcast. I'm Daniel, the host for the show.
And I'm Natanael, dialogue partner for our guests. Today, I'm happy to welcome my very good friend and colleague, Nataraja Kallio.
Nataraja is a scholar practitioner who has headed the Yoga Studies program at Naropa University since 2005. As a practitioner, he spent many years in India learning the contemplative traditions of Vedanta, Tantra, and Hatha Yoga. And as a scholar, his primary areas of research and teaching include yoga history and philosophy, psychology, yoga therapy, and yoga teacher training. In addition to teaching, Nataraja maintains a private counseling practice.
It's great to have you, Nataraja.
Tip of the hat and wag of the tail to you both, my friends. It's a delight to be here, and I look forward to where we're going.
Great.
Thank you so much, Nataraja. So as we're launching in here, I kind of wanted just to lay out a little bit of what I hope to cover, and we'll see what we actually get to and what directions we digress into. But the kind of vision is to focus our conversation around Tantra as a topic. And I wanted to define what it is and talk about what it is and also what it isn't. It's a term that has been in many ways co-opted in New Age circles, and there's a lot of confusion about what it is. And you both have the benefit of having pretty deep personal experience in different ways. And so I'd like to get into both Tantra as a historical phenomenon and really through the lens of your personal experience. So with that said, Nataraja, can you just give us a brief introduction to how you ended up in this world of yoga and Tantra and what you're kind of coming to the conversation with in terms of your expertise?
So mine really starts born and raised in a Hindu community in California. It was the 70s, and the cultural intersection, at times collision, of East and West was truly in full swing. About 130 years after Thoreau, arguably the first American to describe himself as a yogi, after being introduced to the Gita by Emerson, and likely in part inspiring his yogic way of life on Walden Pond. And probably about 70 years after Vivekananda firmly planted Hinduism on Western soil via his very passionate speech at the Parliament of World Religions in Chicago, came the 60s, in which you heard the Beatles singing, Jaya Guru Deva, pardon, the Beatles, and this kind of exponential interest and engagement in Eastern philosophies erupted. So back at home in Southern California, a brilliant and charismatic Indian professor at UC Santa Barbara became the center or guru of this community of young hippies and others rebelling from 60s conservatism. And though having no teacher per se or lineage or practice tradition, he instilled a deep level of devotion and faith, both in him and a broad range of philosophies, mostly from India, around Raja Yoga, Buddhism, Vedanta, and Theosophy. And so soon his students were moving into shared communities, getting married, often under his recommendation. And thus kids were being born, given Hindu names, raised vegetarian, and learning about erudite yogic philosophy on Sunday mornings instead of singing to Jesus. In retrospect, it's hard to say which scenario would have been more boring. But at that time, I couldn't fathom anything more boring. Learning about the Sankhya chart as a five-year-old was parallel to teaching Latin to a cheetah. And explaining my name and background in public schools was always a bit mortifying. But to make, you know, a long, kind of deep, complex story short, as has hardly been uncommon in these past 50 years, the community collapsed, mostly due to an oversized process of transference and countertransference, i.e. imbuing the teacher with a power and perfection that, you know, well outsized his reality. And in turn, the teacher becoming intoxicated, you could say, by the transference and thus choosing to perpetuate it through his influence, resulting in some dimension of megalomania, I expect. Mm-hmm. You know, so soon, inevitably, abuse at all levels, all the famous levels, sex, power, and money began to be exposed, and the community crashed. And apart from a few diehards, most of the community was sent into some level of existential crisis. Even as my mom confessed, you know, at the time she said, I saw him as Krishna. And now reflecting, you know, 50 years later almost, or 30 years later, and really appreciating and recognizing how much growth and discernment and insight arose in my parents and their colleagues in this community. I think, you know, maybe perhaps in the larger sense, it was Krishna all along, but in a wrathful form coming to show, you know, what a razor's edge this path is. So as the community collapsed and many of the parents, the couples, because they came together in this community, also divorced, as did mine, and graduating high school, parents divorcing, community collapsing, graduating high school with a specialization, you know, I think in teen awkwardness and anxiety, as well as a crushing, you know, kind of pants on fire level of existential angst, a longing to know, why the heck am I here? What's the deal? I was determined to leave the shire of my existence because I'd seen little of the world and earned about $3,000 working through high school and just really was ready to set off anywhere. And a friend had just come back from Indonesia and made a documentary film that I was really struck by, especially the artistry of Bali, and bought a ticket to Bali, you know, a month after high school. And being taken outside of my homeostasis, I had no direction, but I decided not to come home and continue this trip, you know, on a shoestring budget. I ended up in Thailand and had been hearing about the Himalayas of Nepal. And when they stamped my visa in Thailand to go to Nepal, the 3 of 30 days smudged into an 8. So I thought at 80 days. And 70 days into my trip in Nepal, someone pointed out when we were comparing notes on our trip, buddy, that's not a 3, that's an 8. And when I got back to Kathmandu and realized the financial consequences of being 45 days over your visa, it was well above what I had. So as an 18-year-old, rather than explain it to immigration authorities or call my parents for help, I decided I would try and sneak out of Nepal.
Naturally.
Yeah, the only viable option was India. So I took a long bus ride down to the border, waited till 2 a.m. to make my great escape, because the border is very porous. It's not like the U.S. and Mexico.
This is a new monastics first, too. This is the first time somebody's confessed to a crime on our podcast. So
an attempted crime, at least.
Yeah.
Please continue, though, Narodras.
Yeah, hopefully this podcast doesn't travel back to the Nepali immigration authorities. I owe them $2,000. So I was walking through the border, and it was late at night, and had my little backpack on, and somebody here, hey, Baba, where are you going? And I turned to my left, and there was 2 immigration authorities drinking chai, smoking beedies. And I just looked up, and I was sort of like, oh, looking for a hotel? And they say, oh, Baba, let me see your passport. Oh, big problem. You're 50 days over your visa. You have to go back to Kathmandu, pay $2,000. And in a moment of astonishing insight, I said, how about instead of me going back to Kathmandu, I just pay you fine gentlemen a $100 fine. And they talked in Hindi for a moment. They said 200. And we shook on 150. And that was my entrance into India. It wasn't some noble, devout pursuit for enlightenment. It was basically to escape this predicament. And to make a long story short, I felt like a fish arriving in an ocean. You know, it was like arriving Varanasi first. It felt like I'd come home in some sort of eerie way that I didn't quite understand or recognize. But in that kind of stumbling into India began a journey into a deep immersion into the traditions of yoga and Buddhism. And I ended up spending 8 of the next, 15 years working, going back to, deepen this love, this passion, this, kind of almost incurable engagement with the traditions of India. And so I began my study in both Buddhism and yoga, and almost in the spirit of an ascetic, kind of carved out my life in ways that it was all about practice, and really being in those early years informed by early yoga and early Buddhism. I really was training my mind in attentional stability, in stillness, in viveka, clarity and insight, and would spend as much of my time as I could in this training and in this pursuit. And in one of my second trip, I met the woman that would fundamentally kind of change the direction of my path. She was a yogini from South India. And after that kind of first encounter, I was determined to get back to India as quickly as I could. And at the time, she was working with the Kundalini Research Foundation in South India under the Gopi Krishna organization that was doing some of the earliest research into the effects of meditation on the mind. And they were bringing in swamis and lamas. And she insisted that they use me as one of their subjects of the study. And they were like deeply suspicious of wasting their resources on this young white kid from America. But she was persistent, as she is. And sure enough, they finally decided, okay. And there I walked into their research lab, and they hooked me up with about 100 electrodes, used an EEG machine to measure the different parts of the brain and its effect on meditation. And first you just sit with your eyes open, then eyes closed, then you do whatever is your practice, and then eyes open, and that's it. And I could see their skepticism as I walked in. And after this hour process, I walked out and I saw the kind of bewildered look of the scientists and this kind of slight wry grin in my teacher. And turns out I was able to pretty much flatline the brain at most all sections. So she felt good that she didn't embarrass herself by using those resources on me. But as we were driving back on the taxi, she looked at me and said, "So you were essentially able to make your mind completely still. Why is it then that you're still such a dumbass?" The term in Tamil is mundo, or idiot. And I was like, huh? And thus began not only kind of a turn in my path, but a radical kind of re-engagement with what I assumed was the path and spirituality. And over the course of, many years, it kind of became clear to me that I'd been using meditation in a sense to clobber down a whole emotion, a whole ocean of emotions, of feelings, of impulses, of, human conditions, that in this kind of deep ascetic impulse, very much, paralleled in some of the early ascetic traditions of India, I was practicing the ancient art of, spiritual bypass in a pretty deeply rooted way. And it was in those early meetings that she began to introduce me to the traditions and the practices of what was this next evolute from the earlier ascetic traditions that preceded it, but that of Tantra. And I realize I've been droning on a bit, so I just please want to invite a conversation. Let me know if you have any questions or thoughts before I continue on.
Well, you just got to the meat of it. Now I'm curious about Tantra. That's where we wanted to focus the conversation. So I'm curious if you can just share a little bit more of this kind of later years in studying with your teacher in India, as well as what Tantra did in terms of shifting your engagement with spirituality or practice.
Yes, wonderful. And, I first feel I need to qualify sincerely that, an academically meticulous and philosophically, philologically, thorough overview of Tantra is not only well beyond the scope of this brief conversation, but truly in deference to the, towering intellects and sages of this tradition, both old and present, this anemic intellect and wobbly practice chops of mine, we should probably not proceed. But, you know, just in case it's a benefit by some chance to someone, you know, I'll share just a bit of what I, you know, kind of glistened from practice and study. But just in, you know, appreciation of how vast and deep and penetrating the views and possibility of what, you know, Tantra does present. So, you know, kind of just a brief chronology, standing before the advent of Tantra around the 5th century of the Common Era, were earlier traditions, varied traditions, diverse traditions of Samkhya, Vedanta, the Vedic traditions, classical yoga, Patanjali, this rich time of the Shramanas, in which emerged early Buddhism and yoga. But many of these traditions posited, you know, two realities, the one that changes, that we're experiencing all the time, and a spiritual one that stands apart, a divine consciousness that stands apart from this earthly flux. And the earliest models, I think both of early Buddhism and yoga, were essentially kind of born in this transcendental thrust to get off the wheel of cyclic existence, right? To bring the fluctuations into a state of cessation. In yoga, it's the, you know, the vrittis are the fluctuations of our heart, mind, body, mind. And nirvritti is to bring into cessation, like nirvana, to extinguish, through which one can withdraw from this tumult that otherwise, if identified with, if succumbed to, captures us, like samsara. You know, some is to bring together, and the Sara, this river, what brings us to this kind of captive state, into this captive river of cyclic existence, is, you know, our attachments, our identifications, our desires to the flotsam and jetsam and line. And there's a kind of an essential dispassion, almost a denigration of worldly existence that helps, you know, fundamentally support this attempt to get off the wheel, to get off the merry-go-round, you know. So the practice, like I was really engaged with, is you got to first slow the merry-go-round down, loosen your attachments to it, lest you be pulled into the cycle of desire and suffering, and then immerse yourself in early yoga. It's called Purusha, that stands apart from Prakriti or nature and separate. You know, early yoga is this division between Prakriti and Purusha. Both are real, but separate. So you're studying this kind of proximity of the two. And where you want to get is from here, worldly existence, to there, that which is transcendent. And then Vedanta posits there is only the one. The world you experience is an illusion, kind of the something, nothing. And as a counterpoint that really took form in Kashmir and eventually spread and informed and innervated many of the traditions of India, including Buddhism and Jainism, Vaishnavism, Shaivism, that which is Tantra, kind of came around and gave these earlier traditions, you know, a bit of a wedgie, kind of turned them upside down, adopted so many of their practices, but reframed them in a very different kind of metaphysical view, and is very much allied with the alchemical traditions of the world. Alchemy, you can correct me, Natano, but I think is born of this Arabic word, alchemet, which refers to the black earth, right? And early alchemists took this very literally, you know, looking for this special kind of material, this prima materia that, if brought through a very specific set of processes, would transform that foundational substance into something more valuable, you know, gold, for example. But the yogis, I think, took it a little more metaphorically, that this primal materia is nothing but the substance of our own experience, a lot of which, you know, it's like if you ever cleaned out your utrap, you go into the bottom part of it and you extract this stuff. Most people are just disgusting, right? But that, in many ways, is the most Shakti imbued material if we know how to work with it, the most kind of rich material if we know how to work with it. It's the those intense emotions, those terrifying places, that fecund material of our existence that we would normally like to leave out or not experience, that for many of us, we practice in a way not to feel. So this kind of spirit of pravriti, of rather than withdrawing from the world, turning towards the world in a vision that's very much at the heart of Sentra, kind of re-envisions the world not as the problem, but an incredible opportunity, that the divine is actually imbued in every facet of existence if we have the ability to see it and experience it. So rather than extricating ourselves from the world, there is a turn towards becoming incredibly intimate, open to our felt experience, and thus emerged a whole technology that, rather than kind of rooted in a transcendent process, though that's also very much at the heart of yoga, of Tantra yoga, that deep opening to what is Shiva in Tantra, which is nothing other than your essential nature, but also the felt experience of life, not just the yummy, but in the spirit of alchemy, also the tough stuff. And so in my own practice, it really began to open up a whole history, a whole kind of dimension of feeling that I'd otherwise ignored, avoided, or hoped would go away through practice. It was interesting because we just watched Ted Lasso last night, and there's this therapist, Dr. Sharon, who's finally working with the coach. And she said, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. And I just can't remember how many, you know, fights I had with my own mentor as stuff began to come up that I just, you know, had been in deep avoidance of. So, you know, it's interesting, like many people that have looked a little bit into the traditions of Tantra are first met with a whole iconography of deities, right? And in one of the more transgressive Kala traditions, we see the Dasha Mahavidya, which are 10 goddesses, 5 beatific, that will stun you by their beauty and their grace, and 5 that are absolutely wrathful and terrifying. You have Bhairavi, who's matted hair, it's unbound, her fangs are bared, her blood tongue soaked, stretched out. You know, she's dancing among corpses, accompanied by jackals and fearsome hags and scorpions all around her. And then you have Chinnamasta, who's severed her own head, is holding it, drinking, spouting blood are her children. And of course, Kali is the world famous of these wrathful deities. Blood-drenched tongue, you know, she's drinking demon blood, a garland of skulls, as you know. And then Dumavati, who's this old ashen widow associated with, you know, all that is inauspicious, unattractive attributes. She's in a horseless chariot or riding on a crow in a cremation ground. She's hungry, she's thirsty, she's needy. She's considered the goddess of poverty, frustration, and despair. Alakshmi, so the goddess of misfortune. You're all aspiring for her, right? But she manifests like the final portal that one must go through to reveal ultimate knowledge. So there's no real equivalent to like evil or Satan in Hinduism, though there are all these kind of wrathful beings and asuras and rakshasas and bhutas and pretas. But everything is seen as having its place, you know, in this universe. So hence the goddess is, you know, at times beautiful. Bhagalamukhi, she who stuns the tongue, alluring, but also repulsive, terrifying. She's, you know, Radiant Gallery or Parvati or Durga, who's like kind of Xena, warrior princess, times 100. So the deities are, in a sense, portals by which we access ourselves, our own nature, and the kind of the deep primitive energies within us. And just as the goddess, you know, transforms herself, the devotee, the practitioner begins to come to terms, begin to welcome rather than avoid, you know, the many aspects of this world, learns to be less judgmental and polarized. And as many of the texts will guide, kind of begin to find creative and emancipatory ways by which we can receive, open to this wild, you know, undomesticated territory of our being. I mean, if the ego is kind of the tendency to hold and control our experience, to try and be someone or something else, you know, all the kind of fixed identities and images of who and what we are and what we'd like to experience, then kind of opening up to these more intense experiences, letting their energy flow rather than fight with them actually begins to kind of dismantle our whole constricted process of trying to control existence. So if I fully open to my sorrow, as these kind of pithy teachings will begin to instruct, if I can open to fear, just as I can open to delight or feeling of pleasure, but this opening, this feeling, this turning towards, whether they be the delightful experiences or the terrifying experience, they begin to reveal themselves as not problems, but possibilities, energies that can reveal insight and even further the depth of our own being. So like intense emotions, we could say, are like that cracking of the egg, the blood shed by the ego. They start to flow whenever we're touched, whenever the defensive shell around our heart is pierced. So trying to control our experience is an attempt to keep this shell from cracking, but letting go, opening to, turning towards, you know, I think is one of the more most profound ways of both opening our heart, you know, rediscovering ourselves as beings deeply exposed to this capricious and, you know, uncertain world, but also a pathway to interconnectedness with all sentient beings, a part of this net of interdependence.
Yeah. So just to summarize a little bit there, it seems like you kind of took us through your own understanding and process of diving deep into what would be more classical yoga, built upon this kind of distinction between the sacred and profane, the unchanging eternal, and the kind of vicious waves of existence. And then Tantra breaks down that scaffolding in some way to say that there's actually an inextricability between the two, and that maybe at first it is essential to create some kind of distance from all the intense emotions and mental activity, but that ultimately a more total liberation comes by actually moving towards those experiences in a kind of alchemical process. Did I understand that right? Hear that right?
Beautifully said. And it really also points to an incredibly important point as you're, you know, also celebrating or acknowledging the importance of these ascetic traditions. It was Douglas Brooks who said, every great teaching is a great liability. Mm-hmm. It's a razor's edge between freedom and free license. So how utterly important are the practices and path of the foundational yogas and early Buddhism in learning attentional stability, a learning dispassion?
Right.
Because it's, and this is, I think, a problem where the Neo-Tantra might face is, that's another conversation, but it's an approach to life that is not rooted in our habitual craving, right? If in working with, you know, positive emotions or delight, sensory delight, which are, you know, is a part of the practice. It was welcomed also as a part of the practice. To approach it just from a place of gratification of our kind of carnivorous desire nature is just feeding that kind of that insatiable desire within us, you know, that can't be satisfied even when one achieves the objects of one desire. You know, it's this unrequitable, unending cycle, you know, that leads to like a hungry ghost state of never feeling fulfilled when we seek fulfillment through the objects of our experience versus receiving them as an opportunity to feel and open to our deepest nature. So, you know, in the Shiva Sutras, the opening line really, I think, sums it up that our essence is consciousness. And then through all of the tantric texts, as is everything that is continuously birthed from consciousness, right? And that's the play of Shiva and Shakti. They're inextricable. They're in this, there's this quality of union that in one you find the other. But there's, you know, I think through many millennia of practice or centuries of practice, you know, probably an observation that entering through the Shakti door, our sensations, is a little more accessible than directly penetrating into the depths of consciousness itself. So beginning with arriving in body, working with breath, working with sensation, working with emotion can be a little more accessible than the direct shot to consciousness itself. I mean, one of my greatest inspirations was Ramana Maharshi, who was rooted in this continuous return to essence awareness in the heart. From, if you follow the root of everything that rises, discover that space in which it rises. And that's, you know, really the heart of non-dualism. But yoga, Tantra just added this equation that so too is all that is birthed from that great space. Mm-hmm. So the ability, the willingness to engage both. One is not the problem in preference of the other.
Yeah, and I was struck by what you made as a little joke about the age-old tradition of spiritual bypass. But I appreciated that because now we talk about spiritual bypass almost in an entirely negative way. And as you're pointing out, there actually is something to rising above, to feeling instincts or urges and bypassing them in choosing something that is other than that, to even just develop the control. And so that there seems to be some kind of balance. And now we're more in a mindset that tends to look upon asceticism unfavorably or as odd. Why would you put yourself through such things that can't be the meaning of life? I think in modern society, with this deep bias against asceticism. And so in that context, while we might share some critiques of traditional asceticism, also want to honor and appreciate all the great contributions that it's made.
Right. I think the reason, you know, both early Buddhism and Tantra engaged Sankhya and early yoga and debate was out of also tremendous respect. And they frankly pillaged so much of early yoga, just reframed it in a way that was more integrative versus transcendent in nature. But we still find, you know, much of kind of the framework and practices of early yoga integrated and adapted within later traditions. And I think you're right, or asceticism gets a bad rap. It's kind of anathema to, I think, the modern, you know, vision of spirituality, of the divine. It's not apart from this world, but imbued within it, regardless of tradition. But also so much of the discipline, the insight, the pants on fire determination to know what's the deal, you know, that is so in the DNA of early traditions is absolutely foundational. Otherwise, we kind of just get into the just using traditions as an identity to make another identity of our pursuit of pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's worth acknowledging how asceticism earned that that dislike. By creating a dualism in which matter was bad and spirit somehow needed to be liberated from this oppressor of matter. And so we would talk about the mortification of flesh. You know, you would want to almost kill the flesh to liberate the spirit. And that becomes, over time, deeply anti-feminine. And, you know, in that way, asceticism, you know, earned its bad reputation by this heavy emphasis on denigration of the body, which also is the body of the planet. And that becomes highly problematic. Now, that dualism is represented not just in ascetic spiritual practices, but in a mindset of capitalism and so on, and a very heady Western philosophy, which divorced its mind from body, etc. So I think, you know, we can acknowledge that. And yet, if anybody wants to do their spirituality without some element of asceticism, they're not going to get anywhere. And that reminds us that we have to understand the word. Asceticism, you know, for us in English, comes from ascesis, which means training. It means training. And so, like, if you don't explore and test your limits, you don't know what they are, really. And you will be shown what they are by, you know, circumstances. Like, you'll quit very easily something. You'll be, you know, asked to do a practice of some length, and you discover that you just don't have it in you to do it. And so your limits will announce themselves. So, you know, true ascesis is to explore the boundaries of our human possibility, to push them, to even do those dietary practices where we remove something from our diet and then we reintroduce it so that we can observe its effects on the body. All of that is yogic practice, you know, where yoga is a great psycho-spiritual experiment on what our possibility actually is. In that, asceticism is essential. So, like, we're distinguishing between these two types of asceticism.
beautifully said. And, you know, kama, desire, passion, love, longing, and Kameshwara, kind of this form of Shiva, Lord of, kind of God of love. We see throughout Indian mythology simultaneously appearing on both sides of the spectrum between integrated life and asceticism. There's a story of arguably India's most formidable master of Advaita, Shankaracharya. This is back in about the 8th century. You know, India is legendary for stretching stories, so take it with a grain of salt. But he was locked in debate with an advocate of a rival school of philosophy, Mandana Mishra. And, you know, debate was always a central part of so many of these traditions. And the stakes were high, because if you lost, you had to become a student of the other, you know, teacher. So he was soundly defeating Mandana Mishra, as he did all of his opponents, when Mandana Mishra's wife entered the fray. I guess a very, you know, sportive woman, sly, witty, posed a series of metaphysical questions to Shankaracharya. And these questions were couched in metaphors of sexual union. And Shankaracharya was a celibate, a monk, and had no answer, because he was at least, you know, had enough integrity not to give an answer about something he didn't know about, right? He had no experience, but also he was wicked smart, so was determined not to lose. So he asked for a pause in the debate. And as the story goes, in borrowed form, because he had this siddhi of being able to not only bilocate, but take upon the form of another body, he asked his students to take care of his body. He'll be back in 100 days. So he abandoned his body and assumed the body of a king who had just died, King Amaru. And, you know, to the harem's delight, their king suddenly resuscitated from the pyre he was about to be burned on, and spent the next 100 days during the day studying Vatsayana's Kama Sutra, kind of the textbook manual of love and intimacy, sexuality, and applying those practices with the harem at night. And for each night, he composed a poem. And he came to 100 days and for some reason felt he needed more time. So it took another 8 days to apply these practices. And upon feeling satiated enough in this art that had previously eluded him, he abandoned the king's body to his fate, resuscitated his own, and re-engaged Mandana Mishra in the question that had previously eluded him. So we see, you know, the closing line of these poems attributed to Shankaracharya describe the love god of Kama, you know, kind of the holy god of love that has the most powerful bow, even more heavy and weighty than Lord Shiva's bow. Yet is only composed of a sugarcane reed, a string of bees, and its arrows are flower tipped. But upon his appearance, you know, these growling storm clouds mount the horizon, signaling the onset of the monsoon. Aromatic flowers unfurl their essence. Animals go into rut. You know, lightning creases the sky. And humans engage in that oldest of rituals, you know, predating religious traditions, the dance of love, fertility. So we find, you know, this kind of tense, continuous, almost tug of war with this force of Kama within all of India's traditions. But it's interesting because in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, one of the earliest Upanishads, there's this passage, you are what is your deepest desire. As is your desire, so is your will. As is your will, so is your deed. As is your deed, so is your destiny. So really, you know, free-framing desire as the root of everything, that nothing from, you know, birth to death happens without desire. You know, we're born, we're bathed in the fluids of Kama. And it's that which brings us, you know, into great torment and to the threshold of the temple. So we see that Kama's arrows can simultaneously resuscitate the closed heart, but wreak havoc on even the most accomplished of ascetics. And this might strike one as a, you know, uniquely positive framing of desire, considering how often it's marginalized in some traditions, frowned upon. you know, kind of at odds with spirituality or spirit, you know, to pursue one, you have to ignore the other. And, but we can appreciate both, right? We can see those very regularly in our media who have acquired all the objects of desire, but does that always equate to satisfaction or fulfillment? No. But, you know, these early yogas really, as we have found in our own experience, saw how problematic desire can be when we let it continuously just foster its insatiable need, right? And just one last story, if I may, that I think, you know, illustrates this. So Kameshwara, you know, God of love. So he's always dancing between these two worlds of temptation and fulfillment. So the pine forest sages were revered for their austerities and status, but essentially lived in the kind of the cul-de-sac of existence, these sexless bourgeois lives that were predictable, monotonous, passionless. And as a result of their denial of kama, they did their puja perfectly, properly, but kind of detached, complacent. So Kameshwar, Lord Shiva, arrives as a wandering ascetic, but being Shiva, the luster, the radiance exuding from him is unmistakable and captivates the interest of the sages' wives, all the more kind of curious and crazed by his utter inaccessibility as an ascetic. His arrival kind of ignites this storm of passion and excitement in the ladies. And the sages, you know, wake up and are kind of enraged with jealousy. Yet simultaneously, they're completely enraptured suddenly by Shiva's companion, Mohini, which translates something as like the most bewitching or beautiful. And of who starts that old ancient yogic hymn, "Om, don't you wish your girlfriend was hot like me?" My kid. But, you know, anyways, they get completely twitterpated and get flung between seething jealousy and overwhelming arousal. Completely twisted and confused, you know, after having traversed, you know, in truly masculine encoded fashion, to quote Douglas Brooks, refusing to ask for directions, you know, going barreling down every wrong avenue. They reach such a stress of point of stress that rather than engage with these experiences or the wandering ascetic, they prefer to get rid of that which is causing so much havoc internally. So they castrate Lord Shiva, which is generally not a good idea because the sun stopped giving heat, as the text says in the Mahabharata, lost its luster, the planet started wobbling off orbit, and spring, you know, didn't come. And even their opinion of Dharma waned, their one virtue, and faltered. They had no feeling whatsoever. So no place, of course, you know, have I seen this kind of battle, this engagement with Kama played out more dramatically in the dance of ascetic traditions and more integrative traditions. And, you know, probably born from recognizing how often that we deny or in fighting desire and emotions, we inevitably become stung by its errors. So that, you know, the great tantric philosophers really attempted to realign kama in the service of liberation, invited us to imagine ourselves and life in ways that hadn't maybe been previously considered. The desire, this world, do not necessarily need to be sacrificed for liberation's sake, but, you know, reinstated in very more encompassing and creative and skillful ways that can actually support our aspirations and fulfillment rather than be an adversary continuously.
Right. And in this story of Shiva, it's clear that there's this equating of sexual energy with the very energy of life. As you were talking about, Shiva's castrated and then the sun stops shining. And so there's this kind of primal energy of life that maybe sexual energy is but one manifestation of, or even a primary manifestation of within the physical body of the human being, the literal evolutionary and genetic drive for propagating life, for continuing life. But this gets us to this kind of question of what isn't Tantra? Because in the New Age, you see many practices that are kind of seemingly aimed at facilitating more connected and spiritually uplifting sexual activity called tantric. And I'm just curious if we can get a little bit into that because it's such a misunderstood tantra. I imagine there are many a person out there who's done a quote-unquote tantric workshop or class or something, and there's probably very little of what you've been speaking about so far in terms of the classical traditions. And so if you can just speak a little bit to how Tantra as a term and concept has been adapted or co-opted, appropriated by the New Age, and what is the authentic, if anything, connection between these kinds of sexual practices and Tantra? Because I feel like it's a point of confusion that I'd like to hear both of you speak to. If you're enjoying the episode, please consider subscribing to our Patreon to help support the production of the podcast.
Subscriptions begin at $1. All patrons receive access to bonus content, curated resources, and exclusive patron events, including live Q&As.
For more information, please check out the Patreon link in the show notes, and thanks for listening.
So yes, if one knew nothing, you know, about Tantra and, you know, went to that all-knowing source, Akashic record that is Saint Google, and plugged in Tantra, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be faulted for initially thinking it mostly had to do with sex, because you'll see all sorts of links to workshops and teachers about, you know, intimate relationship work, maximizing pleasure, sex positive approaches to life, and a whole range that I'm not even aware of and can't speak to, having not participated in any. So this is a real kind of outsider's view. There's probably a great range in what should more properly be called neo-tantra, if even that, which does have its roots, I think, with some early scholars or interpreters or translators. I think John Woodruff was the first that published the earliest, I think it was The Serpent Power, that talked about tantric practice and view. And then there was a pioneering kind of American yogi, I think, Pierre Bernard, who was in kind of a cultist, mystic businessman, and I think established a tantric order within the United States in the early 1900s. And many teachers, you know, students began to pique their interest and believe that, you know, sex and sexual experiences were very capable of uplifting their spiritual lives. And then we had Rajneesh, who wrote The Supreme Understanding, Tantra, The Supreme Understanding, that really unpacked in his own unique way the Song of Mahamudra by Tilopa, and brought another kind of centering of sexuality as a part of Tantra. And then I would say probably within the last, you know, 20, 30 years, it's really burgeoned, not just as a fringe movement, but quite voluminous, I would say, probably in the 60s and 70s again, into what is, I think, commonly called neo-tantra, sometimes California tantra, born in the hot tubs of Esalen. And, you know, first stepping back, that, you know, whenever a tradition travels, it's inevitably affected by the concerns and interests of the cultures it arrives in, for good or ill. And that's why we have, you know, everything from yoga that works with trauma to naked disco yoga, you know, with beer. And so there's inevitably a disparity that, you know, happens, sometimes born from like really important conversations and collisions, you know, because sometimes when a tradition comes into a new culture, that culture will ask questions that haven't been asked before, some which are really, you know, interesting.
Like, can we do yoga with baby goats?
Yeah. You look like you've done goat yoga. You just, you know, the beard, the sweetness.
Proceed.
And nor, because we just don't have, you know, the historical context, like with Tantra from 1500 years ago. And now that we see what's happened in 1,000 years, much of it, or some of it, particularly as it's landed here recently, bears, you know, little resemblance. And, you know, more broadly, sometimes while that chasm can be quite large, in some cases, there's also a shared aspiration and inspiration that does connect, you know, antiquity to now. So in some cases, we can, you know, reasonably affirm that connection without totally mangling history and continue that kind of spirit of practice or insight in our modern day conditions. But when we come to Neo-Tantra, it's interesting because if we follow that thread back, you know, so the text I primarily worked with early on was the Jnana Bhairava Tantra, which offers 112 mini practices that work with all of life, how to find practice pretty much in everything. So you have practices of working with intense emotions. I mean, even how to meditate when you're fleeing a battlefield level of, you know, commitment. I'd be shitting my pants probably, but, you know, I mean, that was the depth of willing to find the sacred in the difficult, you know, that was at the heart of these early traditions, to sky gazing, to bodily meditations, to the vast range of emotional meditations, of course, the deep meditations on the nature of being, of awareness, but all sensory experiences were welcome, you know, into this practice and view, including, if you're going to welcome everything, all the sensory blissful experiences too. So yes, you do have a very few practices about sexuality and sensuality. And if I may, somewhat ironically, but coincidentally, the one sex verse we have in the Jnana Bhairava Tantra is verse 69. Totally coincidental, because the shapes of the numbers in Sanskrit and Arabic are not the same as in ours. They don't have that opposing symmetry. Basically, it's along with drink and food and music, these delightful opportunities to also experience the essence of being, right? As we approach the experience, we immerse ourselves in the experience, but again, not from that cravenous nature that just stirs insatiable desire, but allow yourself to feel the experience of music or food or wine or being in the company of a good friend, how those also can be portals to one's essential nature. So verse 69 here, through the union with Shakti, in this case, your consecrated partner, there is an excitation that one becomes absorbed in, that bliss of union, which is nothing other than the nature of Brahman. That bliss in reality is your own self. So the titillation of excitation when you're with your beloved also becomes this, you know, exceptional doorway into the innate bliss of your own being. But again, is possible when we're allowed to approach and receive this experience, not from our craving nature, but through our ability to really open up to sense delight rather than, you know, package it, try and preserve it and perpetuate it for more of a repetitive tendency and nature in us. So I think that thread that you actually find very rarely in the tantras, and of course we see it in the iconography so naturally, is unions of gods and goddesses. It's natural to infer that this is a part of it. But I think that, you know, probably grossly generalizing, since I haven't studied Neo-Tantra, I haven't involved much with it, so I can't speak to it. But it seems like that single thread was taken out, repackaged, and kind of made its own shtick. You know, just like when we approach, let's say, you know, the digestive tract. When we talk about cultural appropriation, this is an analogy I've seen used. So when you eat something, you know, you first consume it, and once satiated by it, you digest it. So it becomes a part of you, right? Might help strengthen you, and then you excrete what you don't know. I think one of the kind of lenses by which we can examine if cultural appropriation is happening and what we're doing or elsewhere, that same process of first we consume something, maybe a tantric vision or practice, and then we build, you know, a career out of it, perhaps, maybe turn it into a part of it we liked, you know, sexual intimacy workshop. That's then westernized in our own language and culture. And then we trash the original source. In other words, we basically eliminate so much of the vast depth of liturgy and context and philosophy that it necessarily has to be rooted in if it's to really, in a sense, provide that opportunity and depth that the tantrikas intimate is possible. So then if you remove it from all the context in which it's rooted, then it may quite often just, in the sense of neo-tantra, just kind of titillate our genetic organs into, you know, orgasm pursuit or something, you know, that just actually perpetuates the craving and is the antithesis of the context it was rooted in. So when we approach traditions, how do we engage them, I think, responsibly? It's another metaphor I've heard is, you know, the difference between a farmer and a miner. A farmer invests in the soil. It's irrigation, it's seeds, it's strong roots. A miner does not replenish. A farmer nurtures the ecosystem and the coexistence of beings in nature. Whereas, you know, mining quite often leads to ecological disaster and alienation. So long-term commitment versus plundering and abandoning, you know, the origins or the non-renewable resources. One believing in the indefinite supply and harmony that's possible through mutual relationship. And the other is just this capturing of thing for your own pursuit and kind of trip. So I think that's something we can all do, you know, when we approach traditions. Are we engaging? Are we really dedicating ourselves to continuous learning so we can be clear and have integrity in our engagement and approach with, versus just plunder and make it another, you know, identity for our own gratification?
I think it, you know, it brings us back to, you know, when you talk about spirituality for import or export, and when it comes in, the context in which so much is coming in here is a commodity culture and a commodification of practices, a repackaging, as you put it, which leads to a different kind of spiritual bypass than you were discussing before. There's the spiritual bypass of doing whatever we wanted to do anyways, but making spirituality an excuse for doing it. You know, so we have these basic tendencies, desires, drives, and we want to do them. And spirituality becomes our excuse. Like, if you make it spiritual, then it's not coarse. It's not a base desire. And there's nothing wrong with the basic desires, but we can do a spiritual bypass and not recognize that that's basically what they are. And, you know, you're very generous about it. I, on the other hand, don't feel generous at all about the repackaging of our spiritual practices this way, because they're taking a shape which does exactly what you mentioned, just enhances the problem, you know. Once they're extracted and repackaged in this way, they keep us within the pattern of commodity culture. And so, like, there's no escape then if spirituality, which is inherently subversive, is subverted by the commodity culture, then we don't have a way out anymore. And so in some ways, we need to keep our spirituality subversive, you know, breaking the models that keep us enslaved to certain narratives of mind and, right now, problematic culture. I think it's not limited to, you know, sexual tantra. It's pretty much every aspect of our spirituality as it's being sold and repackaged to us today. That's a very clear example, though. And it somehow misses the point. It makes, it's kind of repackaged into a kind of Epicureanism, you know, an aesthetic thing. The way you would want to enjoy good wine or great meal at a restaurant or a great sexual experience in a kind of Epicurean way. And that's not necessarily, though maybe related, to sacralizing, becoming aware of, you know, holiness in a moment, which could be in the drinking of that wine, in the tasting of that meal, in the tasting of that person. That whole experience could be sacralized, or it could be Epicurean. And they may look the same to some people, but in a transformative sense, it's either that transformation is happening or not. In that way, they're quite different. So just some of my thoughts.
No, I appreciate what you both said about it. And again, my interest is really in just people being able to walk away from this episode and have a better understanding of what Tantra is and what it isn't. And I think when it comes down to some of these practices, it's not that the practices themselves are bad, but the packaging of them and selling of them as Tantra is problematic and basically inaccurate. And so we're kind of coming to an end of our time, and I feel like I have a long list of questions that we haven't gotten to here. And so I'm a little bit stumped as to what really feels fruitful, worthwhile to kind of go into here at the end. But I am left with a kind of curiosity, and maybe this can close us out, is for you, Natano, to share some of your experience in terms of encountering Tantra, in terms of your studies of it and stuff. And I'm also curious how you've met Nataraja after all these years in India, and what struck you about his practice, and what, if anything, in the early days of your friendship, I imagine you had some conversations about Tantra, and what was really alive for you both in those conversations. And you can also just veto, and we can move in a different direction.
Well, I don't know if it's a satisfying answer to that question, but I can answer the question. You know, my exposure is limited. You know, I may be knowledgeable here and there, but have no authority whatsoever to speak on these subjects. But in the years, you know, around the time I met Nataraja, I was a fairly serious student of, you know, Hindu traditions, and, you know, was into all the books and learning, you know, as authentically as I thought I was able at the time. You know, Tantra was, of course, one of those great subjects. But in the end, I took away a kind of pattern of thinking from it, which was very much in the line of what we've been discussing, that there are no subjects off limits. There's nothing in your life that doesn't need to get touched and infected with your spirituality. It needs to be processed through it. And that was really the exciting thing about Tantra for me. You know, being a kind of a purist sort of mentality, you know, I was, of course, you know, outraged at the abuses, as I tended to be, but also curious what was underneath them and excited about the ideas. But in the end, I drew the conclusion that Tantra is a very associative practice, and that it wants to build upon the associations and create a very rich universe of connections, so that we almost rewire our approach to what we thought was reality, and we do sacralize that existence and every aspect of it, you know, where nothing is left out or put in shadow. You know, it's sometimes described as a dangerous process, and I think, well, there is some danger in that. And yet, it's danger just like, the, you know, journeys are dangerous, adventures are dangerous. There's the danger of getting lost in the process. But for me, I came to understand that almost every tradition has a parallel to what you would call Tantra, you know, and it is that desire to sacralize existence. You know, even if you take a simple Orthodox Judaism, even without Kabbalah, you know, there's a prayer for going to the bathroom and for acknowledging, you know, and being grateful that the various hollows and ducts of our body are operating well, so that, you know, God is not left out of any aspect. All of that became, you know, what the pattern of learning Tantra was about for me. And then, you know, I think the best thing I can say about, you know, Nataraja and I, at the time that I met, you know, in the way I remember it, we were both about 26 years old. I think we were around the same age and coming to Naropa at the same time. And I don't remember so much our discussions about Tantra, though I'm sure they happened. I just remember that we were such eager seekers and so delighted to have a few like-minded friends, you know, knowing that we were all on the journey together, even if that journey looked different for each of us. You know, we were pursuing different paths, but it all felt like the same path. And I think it was the first moment for me of really having a few spiritual friends where I knew we were all on the journey together. And it wasn't just this isolated search that I was very intense about. that there were other intense people. And even better, knowing that we were individually intense, we could all drop that together and just have fun. It gave us a kind of permission to let down those roles, because I think we knew what the boundaries were. You know, I couldn't let down the boundaries with some other, you know, young men of my age, because then they would talk in a way that maybe I wasn't so happy about. But when it was so clear that we were all on this intense journey, then we could let it down and actually have fun without worrying about it, like going straying into some area that we're not so happy about. So, you know, that's what I really remember from that time. And it's a constant delight to me to think back. That's 25 years. And now Nataraja and I both teach at the school where we met. And to see him there on any, you know, random occasion is like a string in time that connects to that time to now. And it pulls taut, and I have the memories of both. And it's really great for me.
As a fellow stray dog, I am so grateful for fellow stray dogs that keep reminding us where, hey, you might want to come back a little. And, you know, the depth of gratitude for a spiritual friend or friends that help remind us both of the joy and the beauty of this life, but also cultivate that deepest fire within us. It's just something you feel with Natano. It just kind of brings the very goodness and best out of one, but without too much seriousness. And, you know, Naropa is funny because, you know, after high school and I went through this whole Indian odyssey, I had no interest in college. And then I was studying in Tibetan Buddhism and ended up in retreat with Tukul Urgyen Rinpoche, a prodigious Dzogchen master up in the mountains of Nepal. And I walked in. I was the only kind of Westerner initially, where I was down in Bodh and Kathmandu. When I walked into this retreat, there was 10 young American students there. And after going through this study with Tukul Urgyen Rinpoche, I asked, where are you from? And they said, oh, we're from Naropa University. And I, of course, knew Naropa is the 10th century Siddha. Wait, you said university? Wait, you're getting credit for this? And I said, hang on, maybe there is a place for me. So 7 years later, I ended up in Naropa University. And, you know, I think just, you know, broadly, it's such it is such a rich and precarious time both. You know, we're in a wash and an embarrassment of available resources available to us now, you know, particularly in a field like Tantra that just weren't available just 20, 30 years ago. You know, because when I was studying Tantra, I had no sense of the larger context of its history. I couldn't find texts that really situated it coherently in my mind. It was, you know, very naive, much of what I was doing. And now we're finding so many really exceptional scholar and scholar practitioners, you know, to kind of come out of the closet and celebrate probably what drew them to this in the first place, which is a deep longing to know. And so there's a lot more available in ways that we have not had even very recently, which also comes with a caution in this, you know, Epicurean style. I think one of the concerns, you know, having taught at Naropa for 25 years, I do have a longitudinal study of like attention spans. And because there is so much available to us in ways we've never been able to receive, it's very, I think, common to just get into scrolling approaches of study where nothing really lands or has the opportunity to land because our attention spans are so dramatically reduced. So I think if one, you are struck by the fire that this life is short and this life is precious, and I really want to, you know, give my all to what is of most value to me, it takes like some level of commitment and kind of pants on fire approach so that we're not, you know, approaching these traditions from, again, you know, squirrel, 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 because then they won't actually be able to set roots. Yeah. So it's both a blessing and a challenge that we have to face like at no time before. But if you do feel, you know, drawn to studying any of these traditions, you know, like in Tantra, there's just There's this wonderful text I highly recommend, Tantra Illuminated by Christopher Wallace. It's like really the first text that helps coherently set all of these traditions kind of in context, as well as really help a practitioner who's aspiring to learn more, as well as a scholar who's trying to, you know, begin to be open to the depths of practice.
Right. Well, first, I think, Nataraja, I'd like your permission to name this episode Pants on Fire.
Pants on Fire.
You've said this phrase multiple times and it keeps striking me. I feel like, you know, Pants on Fire, Tantra with Nataraja Kaliyo could be good. Maybe a misleading title. Maybe they'd think it was more exciting than it is.
You might want to add Fool of a Took then as well, if you're putting my name in.
Yeah, I mean, we've gone all over the place and not touched so many different things. So maybe the hope of a comprehensive understanding of Tantra from this hour and a half podcast was foolish to begin with. But I just want to thank you so much, Nataraja, for sharing everything that you did. And hearing you talk, you know, there's so much flavor, so much rasa in what you share. And so I hope that our listeners appreciate that. And I'm curious if you could close us out with a little offering of a poem or a song or prayer, as is our fashion here.
As is appropriate. So this is a traditional chant that in essence is, may the fruit of our time together benefit everyone and everything, everywhere. It reads, may there be well-being in all. May there be peace in all. May there be fulfillment in all. May there be auspiciousness in all. May all beings become happy, free from illness, able to see that which is auspicious. May no one suffer, and from ignorance lead me to death. From ignorance lead me to truth, and darkness lead me to light, and death to immortality. So if you just want to listen, or if you know it, you can join me. But just take a moment to draw the breath in, empty the exhale, and just allow the jaw to release, the mind to settle into the heart. And just feeling the heart space open in all directions to include ourselves and the four-leggeds, the two-leggeds, the winged ones, the creepy crawlies, everything and everyone, everywhere. Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu, Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu, Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu, Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu, Sarve Bhavantu Sukhina, Sarve Santu Niramaya, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Tugabhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Satkamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotir Gamaya, Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamana Gamaya, Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnahat, Purnamirashare, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vishishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Harihi Om Tatsa. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shout out to friend of the show, Tree Fort of Golden Turtle Sound, for producing the intro and outro music and assisting with mixing and mastering. Be sure to check out his awesome music and hit up Golden Turtle Sound for any of your audio engineering needs.